hppodcraft.com.
Wealth offers certain advantages, particularly in times of stress. Despite the disruption of normal business routine in the quake's aftermath, it took Keith less than 36 hours to set his affairs in order and board the Air France jet for Tahiti.
That was an excerpt from Strange Eons by Robert Bloch, a book all about sweet vacations. Another good name for it might be Eat, Pray, Lovecraft, I thought.
How long have you been sitting on that one? That's great.
I just came up with it today. I'm so proud of myself.
Wow.
We're talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
We're doing Blocktober again, and our reader, once again, is Andrew Lehman.
Yeah.
Love Andrew. You know how in Cool Hand Luke, Paul Newman says he can eat 50 eggs?
Yes.
Yeah, I like that part.
We're not going to summarize what we've covered so far because, you know, summaries, that's for chumps.
I'll do a little bit just so, because it'll be kind of jarring just to jump right in.
Will it?
But the summary won't make a whole lot of sense anyway, so don't worry about it.
Okay.
This guy, Albert Keith, he bought this painting of a ghoul, which his friend Simon told him was the actual painting that Pickman's model was based on. So Albert basically listened through the first 120 episodes of this show, figured out who Lovecraft was. Then started having all these Lovecraftian things happen in his real life, including a lurking fear murder and a whisper in darkness situation where Simon was replaced by somebody we don't know who. After an earthquake prevents Albert from being murdered by a guy, he realizes this map that he's acquired has the coordinates for Roulier all spelled out by Lovecraft himself, and so he decides he's going to use that map to go find it. See, it still doesn't make any sense when you summarize it.
Ridiculous.
But this is what he's going to do. He's going to go find Roulier based on Lovecraft's notes.
Pretty much all throughout this section, I'm not exactly sure what he plans on doing once he finds it.
Yeah.
That's a big question to me as I was reading. And then as his plan, and I have that, you can't see my fingers, but I'm doing quotes. Mm. His plan is pretty preposterous, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. So
yeah,
let's get into this. Albert, he's on the jet to Tahiti. The plane is empty besides only one other passenger. He assumes this is because of the earthquake.
Yeah, well, it's just two of them in first class. I'm sure there's probably some morons in the back. Some chumps and coach.
So he goes up to the lounge and this other guy does as well.
Yeah, he says they've had a few drinks, so they move into the comfort of the forward lounge.
Yes, he's an older Englishman by the name of Major Ronald Abbott. He is a retired Air Force guy. He has a place in Tahiti that he stays at for 6 months out of the year. Albert gets a bit drunk and needs a sympathetic ear, so he kind of blabs what's going on.
Yeah, he talks a bit about Lovecraft. Major's like, Lovecraft, I don't know who that is. Is it a friend of yours? So he doesn't know who he is at all.
And when they get to Tahiti, Albert gives him a copy of The Outsider and others and tells him where he's staying.
I'm staying at the Royal Tahitian. It's this old, charming hotel. Once you've read, we can discuss who Lovecraft is.
So the next morning, the major shows up and he wants to talk in private. He read the book and gets what Albert is on about. He believes Albert. He's got his own suspicions because his wife is an islander. He's noticed strange things over the years, and her grandfather had stories, not unlike Lovecraft stories, you know, creatures living in the sea, mingling with islanders, and he wants to help with this investigation. This was a bit hard for me to swallow. What were you thinking at this time in the story?
Same thing. It was pretty weird. And the funny thing is when he was talking to him on the plane, he didn't mention, I think all of Lovecraft's fiction is real or anything like that. He just gave him the book. And so when the major comes back, he goes, hey, this stuff is real, don't you think? So he comes to that on his own.
Yeah.
And it's really silly that he's suddenly on board. I guess later we figure out what the reasons are. But even so, he says, you know, I know what you're up to. You want to go out and see if that island rose out of the ocean, right?
But when he does that, it's like, what is this plan? Like,
but he knows that that's what Albert is there to do. He figured it out from reading this Lovecraft book. He's like, I know what you're up to.
So Albert, his idea is to get a plane or something, but the major tells him there's no small charters around. Then he suggests maybe they get a boat, but it's hard to get permission to go out that way. So they'll have to ask around on the sly, you know, find somebody that's willing to do it illegally. And the major thinks he can find someone who might do such things, no questions asked, but of course it'll cost extra. And Albert says money won't be a problem. Albert also says that he wants to get his hands on some explosives. And the major says, it'll be hard and costly, but I think I can manage it. Is Albert's plan to blow up Relay?
Is he going
to
blow the place up or just blow up Cthulhu? I don't understand it at all. That surprised me when he said he wanted to get explosives.
I mean, that sounds like one of our Call of Cthulhu games.
That's what I was thinking the whole time. It feels like a little bit of a shaky role-playing game where you kind of hand-wave some things just to get the action moving. So you met on a plane and you hit it off and he's totally on board with doing this.
Yeah.
We're not going to get into the details why. And then there's like boring things like, we don't want to go through him trying to get these explosives. So make a roll. Yeah, okay, he got the explosives.
He got the explosives. That's fine.
You know, it's just like that. But that's what the book feels like. It really does.
And again, too, at this part of the book, I'm like, wow, this is happening pretty fast. Okay, there's going to be a bunch of other stuff, of course, before they get to Relay. It takes 3 days to make the arrangements. The major invites Albert to his house, but Albert wants to keep a low profile, so he just sticks to the hotel. Mm-hmm. The major found a small Japanese ship, and he says he doesn't want to get the locals involved for obvious reasons. So they set off on the fourth day. Albert notes that he saw very little of the crew as he was on board.
They're shady folks. They're not islanders. They're from some other place.
The captain, he's a very stoic guy, and they travel for about a day. And then on the fifth day, the major pounds on his cabin door. Albert goes up to the deck, and in the distance, he sees it. It's flipping Relay. Like, what the hell? We're barely a quarter of the way through this book, and they're already at Relay? What is going on?
It's crazy. It's so ridiculous. I don't know. I was amused by it. It says, shuddering, he stared at what lay off the starboard bow. It was horrifyingly familiar, and for a moment he thought he was experiencing deja vu. Then he realized that he was gazing at what Lovecraft had so vividly and accurately described in his story. The tip of a single muddy peak upthrust from the ocean depths, atop of which towered a mountainous mass of masonry, rising to a monolith formed by gigantic blocks of slime-green stone. It was Relay, and it was real.
Yeah.
I knew that was coming, because in the paperback that I have of this, they preview that little section at the at the top. It's like a segment of the book to kind of get you hooked or whatever. So I knew this was coming, but it still made zero sense.
Yeah, it's so early in the book.
That was a climax of the whole book that they were teasing out there, but it's in the first third.
It's insane. So the crew is blown away, but they're not freaking out about this. And Albert tells the major to, you know, bring up the charges from below. The plan is they want to get the door open and then drop them in, as in the big door that opens up that Cthulhu is inside of.
Right.
So that's his plan?
I guess he's thinking like, the last time this island came up in the 20s, we were all spared Cthulhu ravaging the earth because of that ship that rammed him and blew him up. Even though he reformed, it made him go back to sleep again, right? That's the theory.
I guess.
So if you drop some charges down there, it'll blow him up and he'll take a nap again, I guess. That's the plan.
But that's ridiculous. I mean, he has no idea. Like, for all he knows, that thing keeps him there. And by you blowing it up, then he's totally free and you just release Cthulhu onto the planet. Like, there's no real thought about what he's doing. It's just this sort of really primitive instinct. Like, just hit it. Just blow it.
I'm all for blowing things up. That also was a way that we solved a lot of issues in the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game.
It was. Albert, the major, and the boat captain, whose name is Sato, takes one of the small boats from the ship to the shore. We get the whole Call of Cthulhu thing here.
Yeah.
They're exploring the city. They find the big door. It's just like the story. Just like the story, Albert touches the glyphs. The door opens. A really horrible gas comes out. He asks the major for the explosives, and the major says, oh, no, actually, they're back in Tahiti, because why would you think I would really steal some explosives? And then Albert's like, what? And he goes, if you would have just came to my house, this would have been much easier. But eventually I was going to come here anyway. So why not?
Yeah. Total betrayal. Yeah. Suddenly this guy reveals he's not some guy he randomly met on a plane. Well, actually, he is. He randomly met him on the plane, and it turns out he's part of this Cthulhu cult.
I thought that he got on that plane because he knew Albert was on that plane. I thought it was all pre-planned.
Oh, well, I guess that's... that should be obvious to me, I guess. I don't know. I was surprised when this happened, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They were going to turn on him.
Well, I mean, it made sense because obviously he's going to meet a bad fate here, Albert is. But Albert is shocked. But Sato, he seems cool. He's into it. The rest of the crew shows up. This is the first time that he's seen all of them. And of course, they have unblinking eyes, wide mouths.
Mm-hmm. Captain Sato nodded at the man. Him long Cthulhu, he said. Then the crew was swarming around Keith, clutching at him with clammy hands to lift him up and over the yawning opening of that demon-fashioned doorway from which something was rising, reaching. Keith could not bear to behold what lurked below. His eyes closed as he fell forward into the blackness. His final glimpse was of the crewmen's fish-eyed faces. Too late, he recognized the Innsmouth look.
So he gets sacrificed.
Yeah.
They throw him in there. What's the point of that? Is that something that they would have had to do anyway?
I don't know. Cthulhu, when he woke up the first time back in the 20s, he just picked up a bunch of dudes and ate them. And it wasn't a big deal to him. It was just something kind of fun, maybe like a little snack. So I don't know if this is, they're trying to get in his good side by throwing him down a little bite to eat.
Or I guess we throw this dude down there and then it'll wake him up. But then doesn't that mean that Cthulhu's going to start dominating the earth at this point?
I don't know. But this is the end of the first chapter.
Yes.
we've got a lot of questions. I'm sure those questions will be answered eventually within this book. Probably not.
Sure.
But hopefully they will. The book, like you said before, is broken into three parts. The first chapter is now, the second chapter is later, and the third chapter is soon. Mm. They're not evenly sized. The second chapter is much bigger.
Yeah.
It's almost half the book.
And that's what we're diving into now. Part two, later.
This picks up with Albert's ex-wife, Kay, and she becomes our protagonist. The first scene is with the firm that deals with Albert's estate, and the guy representing it is called Danton Heisinger. It seems that Albert never changed his will, and after they were divorced, Kay inherits everything.
So, he's just basically told Kay, Albert is for sure dead.
Yes.
She's feeling weird about it because it's not upsetting her all that much.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they're exes, it doesn't really make her feel anything.
So the story is that she's told is that he hired a fishing boat in Tahiti, got drunk, and fell overboard. Kay says that Albert wasn't much of a drinker, so that sounds very odd. But then again, she never felt like she really knew him. He was kind of a closed-off person.
This was odd to me as well because the guy's saying, this is what the sailors told folks. He got drunk and he fell off the boat. So that means that the Innsmouth people that threw him into the Cthulhu door came back to Tahiti.
Yeah.
So like that was just their little errand and then they didn't stay there and worship and become part of the... No. They did that and turned around and went home.
It's just like kind of a piece of delivery service.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe that was the call of Cthulhu. One large human, please. All right, we'll be out there soon.
So we also find out that Kay is a model. They were only together for a short time. Kay seems to pity him a bit. He got with her because she was very pretty, but then she says that she felt like he got bored with her. She cared for him at one point, but with the breakup, she feels like she doesn't really love him. And that's why she doesn't really feel sad that he's dead.
Yeah, this characterization of Kay is somewhat interesting.
Yeah.
Like she was kind of a mousy person, but Albert in his collector's passion, because that was what drove him to be interested in her, he seduced her, and then he got tired of her pretty quickly, the way he would with any other acquisition. But the act of being seduced sort of woke her up to her own potential.
Mm-hmm.
So then she became a successful model. I mean, that's how she makes a living.
So Heisinger gives her a set of keys to Albert's house. She wants to sell it. It has too many memories because she lived there with him at one point. Mm-hmm. And the firm is going to take care of all that stuff.
Here's a 70s reference for you when they're talking about that marriage. It says, let the executor and the attorney and the tax people make an inventory and a settlement, then pick up her 95% and enjoy. She didn't love Albert. He didn't love her. And even if they'd had the greatest relationship since Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra, or Sonny and Cher, it didn't matter now. And I was actually like, wait a minute. I mean, even at 78, I don't know when he wrote this book.
Yeah.
But I think those guys divorced like 75.
Well, he's not up on current events.
I mean, they still did the show together for a while.
Yeah.
After their divorce. In fact, that kind of became their bit, was like digging on each other.
Wow.
But they didn't have one of those great Sonny and Cher romances.
So she feels like something fishy is going on. And that word fishy, it triggers her.
Yeah. She has this memory from her youth.
Kay trembled and remembered. Remembered the little girl, 5 years old, standing on the bank of the Colorado River before the picnic grounds and watching the state troopers dragging the thing up from the shadows and across the sand. The grappling hooks had left their marks, but that wasn't what left the mark on her memory, scored it and scarred it over all these years. It was the absence of marks that had haunted her nightmares, the swollen smoothness of the thing that flopped wet and dripping upon the bank. Long immersion in the water had eroded all resemblance to humanity. The bloated flesh was muddy gray. Arms and legs were flopping flippers ended in fingerless, toeless blobs. And fish had feasted on the face.
So this image, this thing, has stuck with her whole life.
That was probably the creepiest writing in the book so far, actually.
Yeah.
Just that memory. And having seen that, now all she could think about is Albert having died in the water. His body being bloated and eaten by fishes.
Yeah.
These images keep coming up in her mind.
So she goes to the house and she sees all of his masks and things, stuff that he got after the divorce. And she thinks, you know, boys' toys, scary things to make life seem less scary is what she speculates.
Yeah. Yeah, she thinks to herself, I grew up and Albert grew down.
Yeah.
She's thinking, you know, he totally immersed himself in this world of childish make-believe.
As she daydreams, it kind of turns into night dreams as the sun sets, and this guy just shows up unannounced.
Yeah, that's a part where she goes, I was daydreaming. You know what? I should call it night dreaming. And I could see Robert Block thinking, like, that was cool, man.
That was like, yeah.
I got that one, night dreaming. So this guy that shows up unannounced doesn't just, like, show up outside. He's actually already in the house.
Yes.
He kind of steps out of the shadows and says, good evening, Mrs. Keith.
He introduces himself as Ben Powers, and he works for the firm, and he's there doing inventory.
He says, yeah, I was back in the bedrooms going through stuff, and at first I thought maybe you were a burglar, so that's why I was being quiet. But I recognized you from the photo albums I was just going through and stuff in there, that's why I know your name. He shows her he has a key, and he kind of flips his ID to her, but she doesn't really pay attention.
He starts to drill Kay about how much all the stuff is worth, but she doesn't know. He seems to be hitting on her a bit, and he asks if he can take her to dinner and ask her about things in the house that they bought while she and Albert were still together. And Ben is kind of handsome and kind of charming, and even though she's skeptical of all this weird stuff that's going on, she agrees to meet him at a restaurant downtown.
And he leaves. She just must be really lonely, because she met him in such a creepy way, it's weird that she would want to go have dinner with him, but she agrees to do it.
It's a seafood place, a Maxwell's. I'm not sure if it was real or not. I got distracted. I went down that rabbit hole on the internet trying to track it down if Maxwell's is a real place or not.
Yeah, I did a little of that too. It probably was a real place just because he cited other real places in the book.
Yeah.
But things turn over so fast in Los Angeles, it was likely gone way before we moved here.
So Kay says she doesn't like fish, and then Ben asks if Albert liked fish. It kind of weirds Kay out that he's asking, but then he recoups a bit and is super charming again. Kay finds out that he's single. She's like, oh, he's single, he's handsome, okay, he's got a good job, all right. And she kind of relaxes, has a few drinks, has a good time with him at dinner, until he brings up Lovecraft. He says, well, you know, Lovecraft didn't like seafood either.
Right, and here we learn that she has no idea who Lovecraft is.
So he brings up Simon and Albert being into Lovecraft, and then she's like, wait, how do you know who Simon is? And then that weirds her out enough to like, okay, that's, he shouldn't know that stuff. Because Simon was Albert's friend, but why would they be connected to the firm? That doesn't make any sense. And he doesn't have any real answer for that, so she just gets out of there.
The whole scene is really weird, and the way that she vacillates between emotions. This book feels really juvenile.
Yeah.
Like, there's just something off about it.
Yeah.
And I know this is later in his career. I've read a lot of his stuff, and I know he's a very competent writer, so I kind of think he knocked it out really fast, maybe.
Yes?
I think so, because there's also errors in the text here and there. You know, sometimes we'll find that, and I think it happened in the printing, but these are like, he misuses two a couple of times.
Oh.
T-O-O. And then early on in the book, he wrote should of instead of should have. And man, that's like my biggest pet peeve. I hate that so much. But that was in there too. So I thought, yeah, maybe he's not taking this very seriously. It's just something that he dashed off as an in-joke.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I just think that's got to be what it is. Because parts of this feel like, I've read a couple of Ed Wood's novels.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like an Ed Wood novel. Killer in Drag or Death of a Transvestite or one of those masterpieces. Those are actually really good books I would like to cover on the show at some point. They don't have a lot to do with weird fiction, but I mean, those books are just as good as Ed Wood's movies.
Oh, wow.
He also has a book called Hollywood Rat Race where he talks about how to make it in Hollywood. And Ed Wood, who never made it in Hollywood, which makes that book, dude, it is so amazing. I know I'm going way off topic here, but in that book, it's so great because he's talking about all the deals he's making, and then he'll drop little, like, this is the safest place to sleep in Griffith Park. It's like little things that let you know he's totally poor and on the outs. And he's trying so hard to present this, you know, this high profile kind of personality, but he can't help himself. He slips out with these little bits. It's pretty funny. Back to our story here.
Yeah. So she goes back home and she calls Heisinger and asks about Ben Powers. And Heisinger is like, Ben Powers is dead. He died of a heart attack 2 days ago. Dun, dun, dun.
You fool, Ben Powers is dead. I'm surprised they didn't bring that one out again.
So Kay fills Heisinger in on what has happened, and she gives a description of this guy who isn't Ben Powers. Someone is pretending to be Ben Powers because it doesn't match the description of the actual Ben Powers. So it's not like he came back from the dead.
Right.
And it's like zombie Ben Powers. It's no, that's a totally different guy, just pretending to be him. Why was he so keen on Lovecraft? She brings that up to Heisinger, and he's like, I don't know who Lovecraft is.
Yeah.
And nothing was stolen from the house, so what do they do?
Yeah, and he actually talked to the police about this. Somebody finally went to the police, but of course they were unhelpful because nothing was stolen from the house. They just say they'll have some squad cars drive by to make sure this guy doesn't get in there again. But basically, they're like, change your locks is what you need to do. So that's what he passes on to her. Go change the locks both at that house and at your own home.
So Kay finds out that she's got a modeling gig from her agency. It's for some ad in a newspaper. The client is the Starry Wisdom Temple.
Uh-huh.
She's to go downtown and meet with this Reverend Nye at the church. It's a bit strange, but it's $300 just for the hour.
This, you know, this segment here has a real Ed Wood feel to it. Speaking of that, it says, she writes, duty calls. Is that the way a call girl feels about her assignments? Driving up to a strange address to keep an appointment with a strange man who will rent her body for $3 an hour? Moving up to the doorway, Kay reminded herself that there's a difference between photography and pornography, at least in degree. course, she'd had her share of passes and propositions. It was, after all, an occupational hazard in the profession. But she didn't do lingerie shots or nudes, and so far there had never been any real problem. Voyeurs, weirdos who were into S&M and bondage no longer hired models. They did their shopping in local massage parlors or even the corner tavern. That is so Ed Wood, man. There's a part in Hollywood Rat Race, too, where he's talking about, you know, if you want to be an actor, you got to put up with this kind of thing where you're going to get harassed, casting couch kind of thing. And he goes, and more often than not, when those guys are chasing you around the casting couch, it's not because they want to have sex with you. It's because they want to try on your sweater. I'm like, no, Ed. They do want sex. It's you who wants to try on the Angora sweater. He just can't help himself. He thinks that's everybody's motivation. No, no. Anyway, the Starry Wisdom Temple, for some reason, needs a model. I don't know what kind of... They're going to put some pictures in the newspaper.
Yeah. They're going to do a little advertisement, I guess.
Yeah.
So she goes to this place, which is very run down. It's in downtown Los Angeles, but it has a new sign.
Starry Wisdom Temple. It's on South Normandy. A weird little place. She goes in and a man calls to her from an upstairs office, so she goes up to see him.
She meets Mr. Nye, who is a black man in a dark suit, and he's wearing white gloves, which is very odd. His office is wall-to-wall books and piles of books on the floor. They mention that he is very dark-skinned and has an accent, so they speculate that he's maybe African or Jamaican, but can't say for sure.
Right.
He asks if she ever heard of the Starry Wisdom, and she says no. But there's so many other new religions, like, you know, the Hare Krishna, Scientology, to which he quickly says, oh, we're nothing like those. He says, and the Starry Wisdom is not new. Its ancient teachings antedate all other living faiths. But that's the point, of course. Other faiths aren't actually living because they aren't learning. They're dead and done for, victims of today's technology. What did the Buddha know about electricity? Did Muhammad prepare us for the space age? Could Christ cope with a computer?
It is a good point. Could Christ cope with a computer?
But I think that's kind of an interesting idea. You know, just the fact that these religions obviously can't deal with a lot of modern issues and problems that are in today's society. Things like cloning or even the fact that computers exist, how we're supposed to live our lives and what we're supposed to do. They're not really able to, I would argue, accurately give us answers to modern problems that we have. Nye says that these old religions were made for desert nomads, leading an earthbound existence with no thought to cosmic realities. Yeah, like what about space travel? What if we do find aliens? What does the Bible say? It's going to be demons or something like that? Like, well, it doesn't even touch on any of those things. He goes on to say that the Starry Wisdom has been around for thousands of years and the other religions and faiths take from it, but of course they miss the big picture. And Kay is like, wait, do you want to take pictures of me or what? Why are you telling me all this stuff? And he says, well, I want you to understand what we're trying to get across because it's going to be your face. Your face is going to be our face. So we want you to have cosmic understanding in your eyes when we take pictures of you. And she's like, okay, sure. I'll think about it. And as she leaves, she looks down and sees a book by H.P. Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets a friend and a photographer, this guy, Al Bedard, to go with her. And he thinks it's a bad idea to go down to Los Angeles at night. And he's like, the job isn't worth it. It's not worth the money. Don't bother.
But he takes her anyway. She wants that $300.
So when they get inside, they see the place is half full of people, a lot of Hispanic and black people, but they also seem very young. He says nobody's over the age of 30 there. And Holt's Uranus from the Planet Suite is playing.
The folks here in the church, they cut across all economic classes. It says some were conservatively well-dressed and others were tank-topped street people. I just like that expression.
I still, in my head, I keep thinking this is like the 1950s, and it's every once in a while I get these things, like when it said tank-topped. I was like, oh yeah, it's the 70s. It's not the 50s or the 60s.
We called those muscle shirts when I was a little kid in the 70s. Yeah. Tank top was something that came later.
They're burning some incense in braziers. Mm-hmm. Everyone is quiet and calm. They sit and the music changes to Williams' Sixth Symphony. And it makes her think of Earth and the stars and the universe. It says the eerie quality of muted strings invoked images of other worlds, lifeless planets, dead and distant suns, moving like motes of dust in an empty infinity of outer space, which in itself was dying. This was the way the world ends, not with a bang, not even with a whimper, but with a whisper lost in darkness. And I was like, man, that was cool.
Yeah, some good writing there out of nowhere.
No precedent at all.
Yep. I was just like, yeah, well, it happens here and there. There'll be some great writing. And you're like, see, this guy is good at this stuff.
So after her thought, the lights go out and the spot comes on the Reverend Nye, and he's standing at the podium, and they do a whole call and response, talk about the old standbys, Azathoth, Yog-Sothoth, Shub-Niggurath, and they talk about Atlantis and Lemuria and Mu, all the prehistoric places. They talk about how the ancient religions perverted the old wisdom for their own ends, and the old ways were mostly lost, and the great old ones were twisted into demons and devils like Set and Baal and Satan. But we have a racial memory of the old ones deep down within us, and we know the truth of the cosmos.
Right. This sermon goes on for a few pages.
And Reverend Nye says that the earthquake was a sign telling the devout that the time is close. Many will perish. The priests of false faiths and their false prophets, whom men call scientists, together with all those who follow them, there will be a time of terror for them, my friends, and times of triumph for us. Those who believe shall survive. So then he pulls out a box, he opens it, and inside is a shining trapezohedron. Kay starts to feel all tripped out.
Yeah, everybody kind of stares into it and gets hypnotized, including her.
So Al pulls her out of there, and then they leave. Al thinks that Nye was some kind of hypnotist, and the incense was some kind of drug. He's able to hold it together himself, but he started to feel its effects as well.
He says, I remember when I was a kid, my folks dragged me down to see Sister Amy at her temple. And this was about the same thing as that. And that's a reference to Amy Semple McPherson, who's kind of the prototypical televangelist.
Oh.
Who used to be in Los Angeles. She was also known as Sister Amy. Canadian-American Pentecostal evangelist. In the 20s and 30s, she was kind of a media celebrity. Mm-hmm. She founded the Foursquare Church and used radio. Was kind of the first preacher to do that.
I know who you're talking about now. Yeah.
She had, basically one of the first mega churches here in Los Angeles. But she would use effects and lighting and all these sort of things. She kind of combined some spiritualism with what she was doing to get people a little more ginned up about it.
So as Kay remembers the whole incident, she thinks that she actually saw the face of the guy who claimed he was Ben Powers in the church. Mm-hmm. So Kay takes a pill that night to get some sleep. She has some trippy Lovecraftian dreams that night, and in the morning, Kay gets up to call the firm to talk to Heisinger, but she also wants to call her agent and tell him that she doesn't want to take the job. Mm-hmm. So she picks up the phone, and the line's dead. And then she remembers the chant, "That is not dead, which can eternal lie." And then there's a knock at the door, because, you know, the phone's dead.
Yeah, the phone's dead, and so it makes her... That was a really spurious one.
So before she answers, she asks through the door, who is it? And the man says, oh, I'm from the phone company. The phones are out in the whole building, and I just want to come in and check your line. So when she opens the door, she discovers that it is the man who claimed to be Ben Powers. He tells her to relax, that he's not going to hurt her, and that he gives her a Lovecraft book, and he tells her to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, that's what he leads with? He doesn't explain anything. He just comes in and goes, this is Lovecraft. Read this book. And she's like, wait a minute. Who are you? What happened to Ben Powers? What the hell's going on? What's, you know, like, she's got a lot of questions, ones that he can answer. And so he goes, okay, fine. I didn't kill Ben Powers. He had died. I just used his name as a way to investigate Albert Keith. My real name is Mike Miller, and I cut the line because I need you to do the photo shoot for Nye. And she asks, are you some kind of government agent? To which he says, not officially. So is he with Delta Green?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's what they're implying. He leaves her to read the book on her own, and he says he'll be back in the afternoon. What?
It makes no sense.
Who does that? And, like, who would expect somebody to do the thing? And so she leaves, and she goes, well, I'm not going to do this. But when she goes outside, there's a guy with a gun waiting there. He's like, sorry, lady. Get back inside. Get to reading.
Yeah.
So she's got to read a book at gunpoint?
Yeah, basically, she's being threatened into reading this Lovecraft book. And I didn't quite agree with the timeline either, because this dude gave her the book at 11 a.m. and then by 2 p.m. she's read the whole thing, all of Lovecraft's stories.
Come on! No way!
In 3 hours?
No way.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
Also that she even did it, because if somebody's outside with a gun and your phone's cut, okay, you can't call the police, but you better bet I'm going to sneak out a back window or something.
Yeah, of course.
Although it gave me some good ideas about how I could start promoting my novel, Children in Heat. All I need to do is get a gun.
Available on Amazon.
Available on Amazon, and you better read it. You know what's good for you.
And, like, why by her reading it is it going to make her believe anything? Like, why is that going to... Whoa, it's written down, so it must be true. It's just preposterous, the whole thing. Anyway, that afternoon, Mike is there, and Kay has read the book. Of course, the Haunter and the Dark is in there. They point to all the Starry Wisdom stuff and the Shining Trapezohedron. It's all connected.
Right.
And then Mike thinks that Reverend Nye is Nyarlathotep.
Now, that should have been obvious to me, but it actually wasn't.
It wasn't to me either. I did not.
When he said that, I go, oh, that's why his name's Reverend Nye.
So he wants her to get in and find out where Nye's real base of operations is. And she's like, well, we were at the church. And he's like, no, that's not the place. That's not where he works out of. That's a new thing they just bought, and they have their things there. That's not, we want to find out where he really is. And she's like, well, why don't you send some real agents in? And he goes, well, we did, but they're missing. And she's like, whoa. So you had trained agents go in there, and then now you want me to go in, and I'm not an agent? And he goes, well, the thing is, he approached you, so he's not going to suspect you as an agent.
Right.
And then he explains that this cult is like a cult of assassins. And then he brings up Sheikh Al-Jabal, the old man of the mountains. And he says that, now, I couldn't find anything about the Sheikh Al-Jabal. There's a breed of horse that's called that for some reason. But I did find the Rashid Adin Sanan, who was called the Man of the Mountains. He's also a baddie in Assassin's Creed, from what I've gathered.
Oh, okay. So that's probably what Black was referencing.
Yes. This is how it worked. And assassins comes from, I guess, the Arabic word for hashish. So they would get poor young men, get them high on hash. When they pass out, take them up to this palace in the mountains where they would get all this food. They would have beautiful women to have sex with. You know, they would smoke more hash. And then when they passed out again, they would take them back down to the village and go, you were just in heaven.
Yes.
And we can take you back there, but you got to start doing some killing for us. And they'd be like, sure, of course, I was in heaven.
Wow.
Why not do that?
Yeah.
That's the story.
It's a pretty good trick.
I don't know how true that is, but that's what he's laying down.
That's how this whole group of assassins was born, is because of what this sheik did to them that way.
Yes. So Mike says that Nye is doing the same thing and he has to be stopped. Though they're not sure to what end, you know, like what his big plan is. So Kay asks why she should get involved in this whole crazy plan. And Mike says, because I think Nye had your ex-husband killed.
Right. And I guess that's motivation enough for her. This is about as far as I've read in the book. So I think she's going to do it. Well, I guess we'll find out next time.
I'm coming down hard on this book so far. I just want to say I'm really enjoying reading this thing. Like, I've had a really good time reading it. It's hokey. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but man, it's really well paced. I have no idea what's going to happen.
That's true. I really don't know what's going to happen.
I'm interested. I have to say I'm totally interested. It doesn't.
Yeah.
I have not been bored on a single page of this book. So.
No, me neither. And I've been chuckling at it while I'm reading it. And I will agree with you. It's a fun read. I mean, I would actually, if you're a fan of Lovecraft in this show, then I think you'd get a kick out of it. So,
yes.
You know, if you want to find a copy and have at it on your own, because it probably isn't making a lot of sense from what we're saying, because it's very difficult to explain what all of these people are doing. And I think you'll find when you read it that you have some of those same sensations of what?
Yeah.
What? Why? But anyhow, we'll get back into it when we come back next week. I want to thank our reader once again, Andrew Lehman, for doing such an amazing job.
Andrew Lehman is an amazing talent, a wonderful human being, and you should go see his marvelous creations. They are things to marvel at. Mm-hmm. At the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, Andrew designs and creates many of the things, almost all the things, I believe, there. He's just got such a perfect eye for that type of stuff, and it shows in his beautiful, beautiful work. Go to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society at CthulhuLives.org.
Absolutely. I want to thank some of our patrons who are supporting this show and part of our team. I'm going to start with Tommy Smith. Thank you.
And I'm going to continue with Bridget Page.
Nils Hensel. Thanks so much.
Michael Tramov.
Amanda Baxter.
Bryce Helfrich.
Vlad Peters.
Joel Westerberg.
Alec Rader.
And Brent Sperling.
Thank you guys so much for contributing, being part of the team, making all these shows possible.
If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't keep on doing this.
We will be back next week with more Strange Eons. In the meantime, I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.